From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. And over the weekend in Austin, Texas,
Mr. Guerin makes a point of order that a quorum is not present. Based on the tally sheet furnished by the voting clerk, a quorum is apparently not present. The point of order is well taken and sustained.
Democrats walked out of the House chambers at the state capitol just before midnight on Sunday in a coordinated last-ditch attempt to block a contentious and restrictive voting bill. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, not pleased, he says he'll order lawmakers back to Austin in the fall for a special session. He's also threatened to withhold paychecks from state lawmakers.
This latest situation is an exclamation point to what has been one of the most remarkable and conservative legislative sessions in Texas history. It's a state that has generally taken a hands-off approach to legislating the lives of Texans. Two major bills were passed this session. One will allow people to carry a handgun without a permit. The other is one of the country's most restrictive bans on abortions. So what does all of this mean, and what does it signal for the future of Texas and more broadly the country? With us to talk about all of this is Abby Livingston. She is the Texas Tribune's Washington Bureau Chief, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, well, let's start with this walkout. As Representative Nicole Collier put it, it was the last tool in the Democrats' toolbox. But it's really just a stopgap. This bill will be taken up in a special session in a few months, and it's almost guaranteed to pass. What's next for the Democrats? What are some other options that they have at this point?
Well, they don't have many. And this is a consequence of the 2020 elections. There was, you know, a great deal of optimism that they would be able to take the state house chamber and they would have actually had the majority. But, you know, they had disappointing results down ballot. Joe Biden narrowed the gap in Texas to 6 points, which was the closest a presidential's been in a generation. But it appears a lot of Texans voted for Joe Biden and then switched over to the Republican side. Mm-hmm. And so this is a consequence of that. And so I think there's some watching and waiting, but it's not without benefit. I mean, I do think there's probably a fundraising advantage and maybe a little bit of excitement. The Texas Democratic world has been a little bit beaten down since November. And so I think this is the first time I've witnessed them having a bounce in their step and some confidence.
Well, let's bring in Patrick Svitek, a colleague of yours with the Texas Tribune. Patrick is a political correspondent. And Patrick, this legislature is described as the most conservative assembly in the state in over 30 years. To Abby's point, this is a state where in 2019, Democrat Beto O'Rourke got within 2 percentage points of beating incumbent Republican Senator Ted Cruz. Many thought, as Abby said, that the state would flip to Joe Biden in last year's election. If Texas has been moving slowly towards the blue, as some political strategists have suggested, how did this conservative body actually win?
Well, I mean, as Abby pointed out, the November election was a huge disappointment to Democrats in Texas. You know, they not only did, you know, former President Trump carry the state, but the Democrats failed to take the state house majority here, which is probably the most consequential outcome as far as this legislative session is concerned. And so, you know, heading into this.
I think I might have lost Patrick. Abby, I want to also talk with you about something else, this shift in who Texans are sending to Congress. The state will gain 2 seats in Congress per the census results, sending 38 members to Washington. Can you talk a little bit more about that shift?
Sure. So we were actually expecting maybe another seat. The question was 3 or 4, but we actually only got 2. We don't have the maps yet. That will be decided in a special session in the fall. So there will be a special session no matter what. What we've seen over the last decade was Democrats really grew their vote in the suburbs and the cities. And the question ahead for lawmakers is, are the Republicans who control the state legislature is, are they going to be super aggressive in a redistricting map, see how many Republicans they can get, in the here and now, or do they, you know, take it in a strategically conservative way and just go for incumbent protection and draw lines that'll last through this decade if the demographic changes we expect to take hold? But these two mm-hmm. additional seats also up our ante with the Electoral College vote. So now instead of 36 votes that Texas will put in the presidential, it's 38. So that just underscores how important this state is going forward.
Next year, all state representatives and senators will be up for re-election, and we'll get to talking about that more in a moment. But that means all these legislators are theoretically keyed into the mood of their constituents. I'm bringing this up because, at least in the case of permitless carry, a majority of Texans polled said they oppose that measure. Local, state, and police were actually against this as well. Here's Randy Johnston, a gun owner in Texas, interviewed on KTVT.
I don't want to look at every single person I come across as a potential threat. That's not the world I want to live in.
Abby, is there a disconnect between what this legislature has passed and what the majority of Texans actually want?
Well, this is a consequence of the way the politics are structured and turnout. And Republicans in the state legislature, most of them are in safe seats, and most of them exceeded expectations last November. So they're afraid of their base and their primary. And this has been the holy grail of conservative legislation for as long as I've been covering Texas. And so of the people they want to please, they're completely connected. And this is just another symptom of, you need to turn out to vote and how you feel when you have a position on the state of things.
Can you talk a little bit more about how important it is, this redrawing of political maps? How much can Republicans actually change those maps that's going before this special session for legislators in the fall?
Well, at least on the federal level, they have more power than they've had in decades. And that is because Texas is a state that in the past had to qualify under something called preclearance, which it's states with a racist history have to send to the Department of Justice their map to make sure it's not disenfranchising people of color. That went away in 2013 with a Supreme Court ruling. And so now Republicans have more power than they've had in a really long time, and they can really take the axe to some of these districts. I think the question is, again, how aggressive do they want to be? And I watched some of the freshmen who maybe didn't win a whole lot in November, but they are acting like they are in safe seats. And so, I can't read too much into it, just speculate. But, I do wonder if they have gotten a signal that their district is going to get easier. But again, going back to back in 2006, when Democrats really, when they took back the House, Ohio and Pennsylvania utterly collapsed for Republicans. And that's because the lines drawn in 2000 were just too aggressive. And that leaves many incumbents vulnerable in a wave. And so, if there's a bad year and Republicans have been too aggressive, and say in 2026, 2028, a wave comes through, the question is, are they thinking about that? And do they want to protect their incumbents?
Let's bring back in Patrick Svitek. He's back with us. As I mentioned, Patrick, a round of elections is also happening next year for Texas representatives in most statewide offices, including the governorship and all state Senate and House races as well. That is a lot. If the voting rights bill passes later and districts are redrawn, what impacts do you think all of this will have on those elections?
Sure. Well, Democrats obviously believe that this voting bill, Senate Bill 7, would have a suppressive effect on turnout in those elections, either in 22 or beyond. And so that's, to them, that's the immediate danger. Redistricting, Republicans still entirely control that process in Texas. And so they're going to be in a position to draw districts that continue to be more favorable to them. And so, all that could combine to make it a pretty favorable election cycle for Republicans in Texas, again, combined with that national environment where history tells us that, the first midterm of a new president, the party out of power, it tends to do pretty well. So Republicans right now, the incentive, whereas like in the 2020 election, the incentive structure for Republicans was all around the general election because they're anticipating a real challenge there. The incentive mm-hmm. structure this time for Republicans is all around the primary, looking ahead to 2022.
Before I let both of you go, What races are you specifically watching in the elections next year? I'll start with you, Patrick.
Yeah, it's hard to make some to flag any particular races at the legislative and congressional level because we're still waiting for those district lines. But statewide, I think one of the marquee races will be the primary battle between George P. Bush, who's the current land commissioner, and the Attorney General Tim Paxton, who is going to get a challenge more likely than not tonight from George P. Bush. And so that'll be a fascinating race to watch. Tim Paxton, the Attorney General, has had some personal legal troubles for years. And also, it'll be an interesting race to watch because former President Trump has already said that he plans to make an endorsement in the race and make it pretty soon. And so that will be a fascinating dynamic, given that the Bush family has a complicated history with Trump, to put it lightly. And also, Ken Paxton has been a very pro-Trump attorney general.
That's Patrick Svitek, political correspondent at the Texas Tribune, and Abby Livingston, the Texas Tribune's Washington bureau chief. Thank you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
With the Olympics just 6 weeks away, Japan is facing a new surge in coronavirus infections, and there are more calls for the games to be postponed or canceled altogether. The Olympics were supposed to begin July 23rd, a year late, of course, because the 2020 games were delayed. Reuters health correspondent Rocky Swift joins us now from Tokyo. He's on Skype. And Rocky, why don't you start with the pandemic? How bad is it right now?
Japan is now suffering from like a fourth wave of infections that have prompted the government to announce a state of emergency that is still in effect for Tokyo and most of the country, that is going to extend until June 20th. The question now is whether those measures can bring those infections down and relieve the pressures on the medical system to the degree that everyone will feel comfortable about hosting the Olympics 1 month later.
Well, the athletes are already starting to arrive for the Olympics. In fact, the Australian women's softball team is there already, getting ready to train. What's the plan for athletes like that and for, you know, making sure they're vaccinated?
The issue with vaccinating athletes is that the IOC has said that they will make the vaccines available to any of the athletes that want them, but it's not a prerequisite. The IOC has made their own deal with Pfizer specifically to secure an independent supply of vaccines for athletes. So if the athletes don't get it within their own countries under their own regimes, then there is a facility for them to get it via the IOC. And then once they touch down in Japan, there might be another way for them to get it here. But I think that nobody is really quite clear how it's going to work out.
Well, and one of the issues is that access to the vaccines varies widely depending on which country you're from. So how will the Olympic Village itself, where these athletes are living, how will it be secured and safe?
The athlete village is said to be operated like a bubble. Other major sporting events like NBA and other football events across the world have been done in this way successfully, but not to this scale. So the idea is that, you know, something on the order of 10 to 15,000 athletes are going to be in this village, and they're going to be tested at least once, maybe multiple times a day, and they will not be allowed outside of the bubble.
Doctors have been saying that it's not a good idea to bring thousands of these athletes from all over the world to Japan during a pandemic. What's the government's response been, especially now that we're getting just a few weeks out from the games? Are they responding to calls for the games to either be postponed again or called off altogether?
The government has been pretty steadfast in their position that they want to hold a safe and secure Olympic Games. And how that manifests is the question. You're right. Most doctors and medical groups in Japan have come out to say that either it cannot be held safely or it will, you know, take away needed medical resources from Japan's own pandemic response. And probably the biggest concern is the danger of introduction of new mutant variants of the coronavirus that could sort of kick off another wave of infections here and potentially around the world if, you know, once these athletes and other people go home.
How do the athletes feel about it?
I've covered one event that was like a dive, like a Olympic diving test event. And I talked with American and German divers. They said that the facilities they were in were nice, you know, but you could tell they were chafing at the fact they were in this bubble. You know, they couldn't get out of their hotel room. They couldn't like see the sights. So they were deprived of the kind of joys that you might have from a regular Olympics of just, you know, seeing and enjoying the host country. But that may just be the reality of this event if it comes off.
Well, and they better get used to it because we're still several weeks until the opening of these games. Rocky Swift of Reuters speaking with us from Tokyo. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may have noticed prices have been up lately for everything from gas to plane tickets to food, and it's expected to get worse depending on whom you ask. Some economists are debating whether we should be as concerned about the potential for rising prices after a key measure for inflation fell in recent days. Let's bring in NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley to break this all down for us. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Tanya. Good to be with you.
Yes, good to have you. This inflation benchmark economists are watching is called the 10-year break-even rate. What's going on that's changing some investors' minds about inflation?
They're basically agreeing with the Biden administration and the Federal Reserve that the run-up in inflation that we've seen in the last couple of months is a temporary phenomenon. Now, I should say temporary here is a relative term. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen did say a few days ago that we're likely to see higher rates of inflation probably through the end of the year. But she and the folks at the central bank don't think this is going to last for years and years. And that's where the 10-year break-even comes in. You know, you can buy bonds that pay off over time in nominal dollars, and you can buy bonds that pay off in inflation-adjusted dollars. And when you compare what investors are willing to pay for those bonds, you get a read on what they think inflation's going to be 5 or 10 years down the road. And right now, the bond market is telling us investors think higher inflation is indeed a temporary phase, not a lasting upward spiral like the one we saw in the 1970s.
Okay, a temporary phase, but it doesn't change what we already know to be true. More Americans are getting vaccinated. They're going out and they're spending money on things like travel and at restaurants. Given all of this, what do you anticipate in the next few months? What will this look like for the economy?
Well, it could be a sizzling summer for the economy. There's lots of pent-up demand for people to take advantage of the kind of services that were off limits during the depths of the pandemic. A lot of folks have saved up money, so they have money to spend. But just as factories face challenges in keeping up with demand for goods during the last year, now the service sector is going to face its own growing pains. You know, amusement parks and hotels are having challenges staffing up quickly enough to meet this onset of demand as people get vaccinated. So you're likely to see airplanes that are more full, hotel rooms that are booked up more, and rental cars that are more expensive.
Let's also talk about gas prices for a minute. They jumped to their highest level in 7 years over the Memorial Day weekend. But that's after they fell below $2 per gallon during the depths of the pandemic. What does that mean for inflation?
Yeah, it really just means gas prices are kind of back in their normal pre-pandemic range. They were really depressed for much of the last year. You might remember that oil prices actually went negative at one point in the last year when everybody basically stopped driving. But now people are driving again. Memorial Day is always a busy driving weekend. Of course, here on the East Coast, we just recently went through the Colonial Pipeline shutdown, which crimped gasoline supplies. But basically, gas prices are back in the normal range. OPEC and Russia, which had shut in a lot of production during the depths of the pandemic to kind of put a floor under prices, are now gradually opening the taps. So while gas prices are above $3 a gallon now on average across the country, I don't think that's going to necessarily move the needle a lot on background or core inflation.
You know, we've also been watching for months manufacturers across the board deal with parts and labor shortages. The port here in LA is still a mess. It's creating a backlog and a lot of unfilled orders. Obviously, increased consumer demand means the economy is getting stronger, but what are the long-term consequences if these manufacturing problems persist?
Well, we're hoping that they won't persist long term, but they are a headache right now. It's really challenging. There was a survey of manufacturers out just this week which showed really strong demand from consumers, both here in the U.S. and from export customers overseas. But despite that strong demand, factories are having trouble keeping up. Tim Fiore, who conducts that survey, says they're facing an obstacle course of part shortages, labor shortages, demanding customers, and transportation hiccups like that traffic jam at the West Coast port you mentioned. All that said, though, this is a good problem to have. It is a consequence of strong demand. And so while there are headaches associated with that, they're the headaches of a crowded restaurant with a line out the door. And if you're the restaurant owner, that's a much better problem to have than, you know, an empty restaurant and no customers. The key thing is, do people think this is going to be a short-term bottleneck that resolves itself as opposed to a lasting spiral? And we've had decades of stable prices now, which have really shaped consumers' expectations, where they're sort of prone now to expect prices to revert to the normal price after a hiccup like this. And so long as those expectations stay in that range, we should have a resolution and not a long-term lasting problem of inflation.
That's NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley. As always, thank you so much.
Great to talk with you.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
A new variant of COVID-19 has been found in Vietnam, and it's actually not just a new variant. It's a combination of two previous strains, ones first found in the UK and India. And in response, Vietnam has imposed a two-week shutdown of Ho Chi Minh City and is trying to test all 9 million residents. Here to tell us more about that is Drew Joseph. He is with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Drew, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Sounds like Vietnam is taking this new strain very seriously. What do we know about it?
Honestly, at this point, not a lot. What health authorities there say is that they found this new variant that appears to be driving cases there in Ho Chi Minh City. And Vietnam has been sort of a model for containment throughout the pandemic. So it's kind of with their history that they're cracking down on this so aggressively. But at this point, it takes some time for scientists to sort of characterize what a variant can do or what it means. You know, it's possible that this variant isn't all that different from some of the other variants that we've seen throughout the pandemic. So it's sort of hard to tell how big of a deal this is. You know, we've seen throughout the pandemic some sort of alarming headlines about new variants, and then they kind of quickly fade. So it's a little bit early days still with this one.
Yeah, and I did mention that it's a combination of two previous variants. Can you explain that and what it might tell us?
Yeah, again, I think scientists are still trying to figure it out. But basically, it sounds like this variant that's driven a lot of the cases in India and has started to spread around the world, it's called B1617.2. What's more likely is that it didn't just sort of combine with another virus somehow. What's more likely is that that variant, as it was spreading in Vietnam, maybe picked up another mutation, one of the mutations that's seen in B117, which first emerged in the UK. And that's actually not uncommon. People know there are different variants out there that scientists are worried about, but despite them being different variants, a lot of them actually have similar mutations or even the same mutations in different cases. So it's possible for the virus to, as it mutates, as it evolves, as it spreads, sort of land on some of the same mutations, particularly if it gives the virus a, you know, for example, a transmission advantage. So I don't think it's like two viruses necessarily combining. It's probably just an example of what, you know, scientists call convergent evolution.
I see. So scientists are looking more into this. Do we know yet whether vaccines are working on this strain?
You know, I think it's still too early with this, but the good news is that scientists have sort of compared vaccines to this B1617.2 variant that first emerged in India, and it seems like this one is pretty similar, and vaccines have stood up to that virus just almost as effectively as, you know, as sort of the earlier strains of the virus. So I think scientists have so far been sort of heartened by how strongly the vaccines are standing up to all of the variants at this point.
Yeah. So, you know, Drew, the World Health Organization has announced that it's going to start using the Greek alphabet to rename all these emerging variants. So instead of, you know, you've been saying B1671.2, you know, the variant from India, it's now just going to be called Delta. Why?
Yeah, for a couple reasons. One is, as your listeners probably know, it's a mouthful, and I apologize for that. The other reason is that health authorities really try to steer people away from labeling things, you know, dubbing things like, you know, call it the Massachusetts variant, you know, for example. They don't want, they view that as stigmatizing. They worry about countries maybe fearing that stigma. They won't report if they see a new type of virus. So, I mean, it's in the same way that, like, you know, you can say that this coronavirus, like, emerged in China, for example, but they really steer away from people trying to, you know, tag it with a term I won't use. So it's sort of similar in that.
Drew Joseph, reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Thank you very much, as always.
Thanks so much.
You know, music is a hard thing to cancel. That's the sentiment from writer Jody Rosen.
You know, music is kind of there even when you don't summon it. If you're walking the streets, you know, it comes at you out of an open car window. If you walk into a store or a restaurant, there's often music playing.
Rosen recently explored this idea for the LA Times after the re-release this year of expanded digital versions of the Jackson albums. Michael turned out to be the trailblazer, as we know, and to this day, almost every genre of music and dance has been influenced by his contribution. But as we also know, before and after his death in 2009, Jackson was also accused of child sexual abuse. He was never convicted of a crime. So the question Jody Rosen takes on is whether we can separate Michael Jackson from the Jacksons, and do we really want to? Jody joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Tanya.
Well, as you've written, you say listening to music in general is sort of a calculation of moral math. But in this piece, you explore this question: if MJ is canceled, can we still enjoy the Jacksons? But first, the big question, is Michael Jackson even canceled? And I want to make a note to say you don't like that term, cancel, but rather holding people accountable.
So in terms of Michael Jackson's, you know, cultural status, you know, he is in this unique sort of gray area these days, I'd say. There was, of course, these charges of child sexual abuse that dogged him during the last decades of his life, and these charges resurfaced dramatically in the 2019 documentary Leaving Neverland, in which we heard from two of Jackson's alleged victims who, to my mind, you know, offered quite compelling testimony about their abuse at Jackson's hands. So on the one hand, that's very disturbing for a lot of people, for a lot of listeners, a lot of people who felt strongly about him personally as a guy. But we need to note that Michael Jackson had his day in court while he was alive. He was found not guilty in a trial involving a different alleged victim. So that makes his status slightly different than someone, for instance, like R. Kelly, who is a musical artist who, for one thing, is still alive, is still with us. So for that reason, I think Michael Jackson's status is a little uncertain. And the question is what we do with those feelings about his personal behavior and this incredible body of work that he's left behind now that he's no longer with us.
Well, do you think the resurgence of the Jacksons' music brought by these newly released editions is actually going to prompt a reckoning?
I think this is a kind of a complicated issue that we're going to be dealing with on and off for the foreseeable future, because Michael Jackson's music was so popular and great and ubiquitous, and record companies are not going to be shy about continuing to push that product out because there's money
to be made.
They make lots of money. There's a Michael Jackson musical planned for Broadway. So that will be another, I think, signal moment in this process where people are going to be, you know, asking themselves, what do we do with this music and with all the questions that are kind of swirling around Michael Jackson's legacy?
Well, the Jackson story is certainly an American story. A father with a slew of talented kids pulls the family up from poverty and turns them into one of the biggest acts of all time. But in this piece you write, you talk about these dark, troublesome themes in some of the Jacksons' most popular music from the 80s, that little bit of time you're talking about when they were this group, the Jacksons. This Place Hotel is one of those songs, which also features his brothers. Let's listen. Jody, was this a precursor to what we would later hear about Michael? What did this music reveal?
In terms of the lyrical content, that is, it's kind of a crazy song. It's about a guy who goes with his girlfriend to a hotel, somehow magically in this, or maybe not magically, in this kind of horror movie way, there are ex-girlfriends of his in the hotel room. So the idea is that this guy has been set up, his girlfriend leaves him. It's sort of a preposterous B-movie plot, I don't know what you'd call it, but what I think you hear in there is you hear themes of paranoia, specifically sexual paranoia, that would surface in later songs, some of Jackson's most famous songs. For instance, Billie Jean. I mean, you can trace this clean through his discography as a solo artist. And so I think that's what's one of the things that makes the re-release, from a historical point of view at least, extremely interesting. It's a chance to kind of trace these themes. And he's a person whose personal demons were right there in the music.
How would you factor in the other members of the Jackson family and how they play into all of this as we think about revisiting this music and how we should interpret it?
Listening to this music again, I mean, you know, I hesitate to kind of confirm these cliches that it was just kind of Michael and his brothers were a backing band, but that's really where I came down. They were guys who could sing and dance, play instruments, but they were not Michael Jackson. You know, Jackson was not just clearly the star of the group, but he was just this, you know, supernatural talent. And that was a source of great tensions within the group over the years, and especially during the kind of later period. After the 1979, when Jackson released his solo album, Off the Wall, he suddenly wasn't just little Michael Jackson, the lead singer of the Jacksons or the Jackson 5. He was this bona fide superstar. So by 1984, when the Jacksons were putting out an album called Victory and they went out on a tour, Michael Jackson was the star of the Victory tour, and the Jackson brothers themselves were very much an afterthought, and, you know, they were traveling separately to gigs. Eventually, it sort of broke the group up. So that's definitely something you hear listening back to these.
There is something almost redemptive that happens to the complicated legacy of famous people when they die. And we see this with Michael Jackson's legacy. It's why you wanted to write about it. I'm wondering how you're personally viewing it.
It's, you know, as I say, it's complicated. I personally, when I listen to music, when I experience art, I feel like one has to make a separation between the artist and the art to a certain extent, because where do you begin to draw the line? I mean, like, you know, there's so many great artists who led complicated lives, who led morally compromised lives. What we have left after those people pass is the art itself. And one of the things, as I say, that makes Jackson's music so interesting is the fact that you can get the whole messy picture of Michael Jackson, the man and the artist, in the music itself. So I can't claim to take some indignant stand and not listen to Michael Jackson's music. I don't want to deny myself the pleasure of his music, because that pleasure remains acute despite uncomfortable things about his personal behavior.
Here's another question. Is the onus of deciding the morality of who we listen to with a clean conscience on the listeners? Doesn't the music industry have an obligation to?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can't count on the music industry to be moral arbiters of almost anything. It's an exploitative history. Exploitative both towards audiences and artists. So for that reason, one would think that if Michael Jackson was credibly accused of this stuff, his record company has some responsibility to say something, make some statement. But, you know, back to your original question about the cancellation of music. A, is it even possible? B, is it something that we want? I mean, you know, the art is going to be around no matter what any record company does. I mean, it's not even, you know, technologically possible to wipe Michael Jackson's music off the face of the earth. I think the music business's responsibility is maybe to clean its own house up, maybe so that there is less bad behavior within the music industry. So, yeah, I think that it's not even realistic to ask that, you know, the music industry ban this or that artist. It comes down to a decision that the individual listener or consumer of music has to make him or herself.
Jody Rosen is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and we will link you to his piece in the LA Times at hereandnow.org. Jody, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks so much.
In many parts of the country, strawberries are getting plump and juicy. And who doesn't love a fresh strawberry? Our favorite chef, Kathy Gunst, has some very good ideas to make them taste even better. Hey, Kathy.
Hello, Peter.
So we're going to get into these strawberry recipes of yours. But first, we have to get past the point where we just pick them off the bush and pop them in our mouths, right?
Well, it's hard to get past that point because there are a few summer pleasures as wonderful as, you know, picking your own strawberry at a field, at a farm, from a farmer's market. When they're warm and juicy and ripe, there's really nothing that's quite that great.
I agree. And when you get those strawberries, what's the best way to keep them? Do you put them right in the refrigerator or out on the counter?
I try not to refrigerate them because that does alter the texture and stops the flavor from developing. But if you're not going to eat them within 24 hours, you will need to refrigerate them. However, do not wash them before you eat them because once they get that moisture, they absorb some of it and they start to rot. So wash them as you eat them. And again, no refrigeration for 24 hours. But after that, you want to refrigerate them. And ideally, you don't keep them in the pint or the quart, but they go in a single layer, so they're not on top of each other.
Hmm. All right. Good to know. Now, you have a recipe that uses both cooked and uncooked strawberries. Tell us about that.
I do. This is an old favorite of mine. It's a strawberry glaze pie, and you bake a pie crust, either one that you make or one that you buy. No shame there. And you'd have 2 quarts of strawberries. You take the most beautiful strawberries. You bake the pie shell. You let it cool, and you fill it with these berries tip side up, so stem side down, so they're just so beautiful looking. And then you use the other quart of strawberries, mash them in a skillet with some water and sugar and let them boil down, a little bit of lemon juice and cornstarch. And that is a glaze. Put it through a sieve and then you pour the glaze over these spectacular strawberries. And you have this strawberry glaze pie that is every bit as tasty as it is stunning looking and not complicated.
Tell me more about that glaze. That is always my favorite part of a strawberry pie.
That's all you do. You mash the fresh berries. You get the sweetness from the berries and the juice with some water and sugar and a little bit of cornstarch to thicken it, and you're there.
All right. All right. Sounds great. So let's go to the next one. You have a recipe for strawberry jam, which could be complicated normally because you need the special jars and something called pectin.
Yeah, but we're going to avoid all of that. And I know you're thinking, oh, I don't have time to make jam. But actually, you do. So again,
sure?
You take fresh... Yeah, I'm sure. I know you have a full-time job, but listen to this, okay? You mix fresh berries with some sugar. I add ground ginger, you know, dry ginger and lemon juice. Boil it over a high heat. Mash it with a potato masher. And then the lemon juice and the natural pectin in the strawberry, it thickens on its own and becomes a jam. And then I stir in crystallized ginger at the end, which you, if you like ginger, you'll love this. If not, you can avoid that. And this is a jam that you can keep in your refrigerator for at least 2 weeks. It's thick, chunky, bright red, wonderfully sweet and summer-like. And honestly, it'll take you less than half an hour. And you will feel so proud.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll try it. I will. Now, you are going to roast strawberries in this next recipe. That is a surprise. I've never done that.
It is. It is. I am not a huge fan of savory dishes with strawberries. You'll sometimes see, you know, chicken with roasted strawberries, or you'll see fish with a strawberry vinaigrette. It just turns me off. But I decided to roast strawberries with a little coating of olive oil, sea salt, and a pinch of sugar. And what happened is that the sweetness and the berry flavor intensified. I only roast them for 10 minutes. They hold their shape. And then I made this gorgeous, really sophisticated looking salad that's so simple. Sliced radicchio or red cabbage that's slightly bitter. Thinly sliced radishes. You get the peppery bite. Creamy crumbled white feta cheese, and then these roasted strawberries. And the dressing is just the juices that form in the skillet that you roasted them in. So you don't have to make a separate dressing. It is, you should check out the website. It's a very stunning looking salad.
We will direct people at hereandnow.org, but when you say roasted strawberries, it sounds like an oxymoron. Why does this one work for you if, you know, typically you don't like to roast them?
I think the olive oil and the sea salt transforms the sweet berry into something savory that then worked with these salad ingredients. It was something about balance. What I don't like are like salad dressings that are pureed strawberries and super sweet. I don't know, but boy, this very simple technique won me over.
Mm. And just real quick, Kathy, should we be guilty if we eat a lot of strawberries? Are they good for you?
No guilt here at all. They're 91% water, no fat, and they're 32 calories apiece. So take your kids out, pick strawberries, tons of vitamin C. Okay.
Kathy Gunns, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.